Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Ever dream of learning a new language or to play an instrument, but felt it was too late? There might be hope. Two new books offer a glimpse into what the brain is capable of and offer some tricks to learning new skills even in adulthood. Joining me in the studio, Gary Marcus. He's author of the new book titled Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. And Michael Erard, he's author of Babble No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. I'll look forward to hearing from you throughout the hour. You can join us by phone, email, Facebook, or Twitter. And good morning to both of you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Good morning, Dan.
Good to have you here. Gary Marcus, let's start with you. I know you've studied brain development at infancy. What can you tell us about the ability to learn language and music in infancy?
Infants are born being able to learn. They're really interested in what's going on. And even before they're talking, they're really analyzing the world, trying to understand the language around them. So one study that I did several years ago was with seven-month-old babies, and we just played them sentences in a made-up language. And we didn't pay them like we pay our undergraduate subjects. They were just there, you know, doing it out of the kindness of their parents' hearts, really. And they would sit there. They would listen for 2 minutes to a bunch of sentences. They'd be like, la-ta-ta, ga-na-na, produced by a speech synthesizer. There was no formal content in them. There was just these sentences. And the 7-month-olds would listen for 2 minutes, and then we would either change it up and give them a different kind of sentence, like wo fe wo, which had a different structure, or wo fe fe that had the same structure. If we changed the structure, they were interested. They would listen longer. So we could tell, even though they weren't talking yet, they were trying to figure out, hey, what is this language stuff that's going on around me? Turns out they can't do that with music quite as quickly. So we did follow-up studies, and they can do it with language at 7 months, but music, they're not quite as keyed into the abstract structure of. And
so what does that say to you about the ability of individuals as they get a little older, say 4, 5, 6, to take in those different sounds, imitate them, learn new things?
Well, I think every human being is born with the ability to acquire language. They all do it pretty effortlessly. Many people acquire music. It's not quite as effortless for some people like me. Maybe we'll talk about that later. Music did not come naturally for me, unlike language. And there are individual differences. So some people have a little bit more aptitude than other people. But everybody certainly starts with an ability to learn language. And I think that actually contributes to the ability to learn music.
And turning to you, Michael Erard, you looked at people who can speak many, many languages. Yeah. Was there a common factor that sort of linked these people?
One thing that definitely linked them was the fact that they spoke a lot of languages at varying proficiencies. So one common notion is that to be a hyperpolyglot means that you...
Hyperpolyglot.
Yeah,
what a word.
That they speak all those languages to the same degree. You know, but even multilinguals or bilinguals commonly don't have their languages in equal proportions. And so the polyglots sort of have this kind of patchwork of abilities. They'll have very high proficiency in a group of languages, then some middling proficiency, and then a long tail, I call it, of surge languages, languages that they need to activate in memory in order to be able to use.
Do their brains function differently
than ours?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an open question. I mean, I think that they learn second languages like everyone else learns second languages, and they process them in the same way. They have components of language learning aptitude. They may be able to pay attention to the grammatical structures of languages in particular ways. They may be able to discriminate sounds differently. And they may also have memories that are different. They create memories and are able to retrieve them more quickly in order to be able to use them.
Michael Erhard. His new book is titled Babel No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. And Gary Marcus, his new book is titled Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Gary, I wonder if you see differences in the brain between learning language and learning music.
So there's a lot of overlap in the brain between the ways in which we learn language and the ways we learn music, but they're not identical. So both language and music, for example, are hierarchical structures. You can take small pieces and make larger pieces and then make still bigger pieces. So you can take a word, put it together in a sentence, and put the sentence together in a paragraph, or you can take a few notes, put those together into a motif, and create a whole song. So parts of the brain, like Broca's area, that seem to be heavily involved in that kind of process.
What's that area?
It's called Broca's area. It was discovered 150, 200 years ago. And that's the thing that people most associate with learning language.
Where is it?
It's on the left side, sort of a little bit of, in front of your ear.
Okay.
However, I want to put a codicil on that, which is people always talk about language in Broca's area, but what we now know is that a lot of the brain is involved in language and in music. So they're both actually spread throughout the brain. So if you read a textbook, it'll say language is in Broca's area. But what we now know is that both of these skills, language and music, draw on all kinds of different parts of the brain.
Michael, you were shaking your head.
Oh, nodding. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Language learning, particularly second language learning, is something that engages all the parts of the brain. When you were asking about where Broca is, in Babel No More, I give a metaphor for the brain as a globe. So if you imagine holding the globe with the prime meridian right in front of you and your hands on the equator opposite each other, Broca's would be sort of between your thumb and your forefinger, sort of the Indian Ocean, Saudi Arabia.
Tell me what set you off on this learning process about these people who are able to learn so many languages.
It was really a discussion among linguists on a listserv back in 2004, where people asked, who is the most lingual person in the world? Who is the person who speaks the most languages? And there was such a huge amount of disagreement over whether or not that person could actually exist that I knew that there was a story to be told. So I wrote a magazine article for The New Scientist about it. But even then, there were so many questions that were that I needed more room. So what does it mean to speak a language? Who are some of the historical characters? Are they myths or are they real? How were their stories inflated and reflected by their times? And how were the standards of what it meant to know a language or speak a language, how did those help create their myths?
And did you find one person in the world that you can say knows the most languages?
I did. Oh, do I have to tell you who it is?
Yeah.
So... So there was in 1987 and in 1990, there were two contests in Brussels, one to find the most multilingual Belgian and the second one to find the most multilingual European. The second contest was even more stringent than the first, and the person who won was a Scottish church organist named Derek Herning. He lives in the Shetland Islands, and he was given points for being able to communicate, being able to converse with native speaker judges in something like 22 languages.
Did you speak with him?
I've spoken with him many times on the phone. He received he's quite an interesting fellow. He received some huge brass trophy, which he took back home with him, and I asked him if he still has it, and he said, "Oh yes, my wife, she hangs her hat on it."
And the second place went to...
Oh, I don't remember. That's lost.
Somebody
time.
Who spoke perhaps 20 languages
something
rather
like
than
that.
22.
Yeah.
And did you talk to this person about how he was able to acquire so many languages?
I did in very general terms. One of the interesting things about Derek and a lot of these other characters is that a language barrier doesn't exist for them. Someone speaking another language or a place or a menu, or to them, it's an opportunity to learn something else. And in the book, I call it this will to plasticity, you know, this commitment to have a different brain tomorrow than the one that you had yesterday. And they really embrace that fully.
How many languages do you speak?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I call myself a monolingual with benefits. You know, I basically speak English, but I've studied some other ones, too.
Go ahead, Gary.
I was just going to say, you see that same will to plasticity in professional musicians who have the same drive. There are some who play many, many instruments. Like Prince plays all of the instruments, I think, on one of his records, and you can play like a dozen different instruments. And so I think, you know, he learned a few as a kid and he just kept going, and he loves learning new instruments. And there are a lot of people like that.
Teaching himself.
Yeah. Teaching himself. I'm sure he takes professional lessons. Paul McCartney was like that too. I think some of the tension in the Beatles came when Paul started playing the drum fills when Ringo was out having a cigarette.
Gary Marcus, his new book is titled Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. And Michael Erard, his new book is titled Babble No More. We're going to take a short break, but you can call us 800-433-8850. Send us your email, your Facebook postings, or tweets. And welcome back. I have two most interesting gentlemen here in the studio with me. Michael Erard has been looking for the world's most extraordinary language learners. He's written a book titled Babble No More. Gary Marcus has written a book. His is titled Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. Our lines are filled right now. We'll get to the phones very quickly, but you can join us by sending an email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also send us a posting on Facebook or a tweet. Tell me how you worked or watched young children, Gary, as they learned to play an instrument.
I did a great deal of watching young children learning to play, children of different ages. So everywhere from a year or two, using something called the Dalcroze method, where the kids would walk around the classroom and the teacher would play in time with the kids in order to get the kids to understand the relation between the tempo of music and the tempo of what the kids were doing. What I loved about that is it was the teacher matching the kids rather than making the kids match the teacher. So I sat in on that. I sat in on Suzuki guitar lessons with a wonderful teacher in Brooklyn named Michelle Horner, and a student of hers that has practiced every day for the last 2 years. And I allowed her to close the opening that I did in New York the other day. It was fantastic. And then I also went to a summer camp in Baltimore just up the road called Day Jams. And the idea of this summer camp is that a bunch of 11-year-olds get together on day one on Monday. They've not played before, and some of them haven't played before at all, and they certainly haven't played together before. And by Friday, they play on stage with their parents. And I joined the band. I learned to play bass for the occasion. And I brought my parents. It was one of the most terrifying things I ever did.
Really? How did they react?
I think my parents were supportive. My grade school teacher did come and tell me that I shouldn't quit my day job, I have to admit.
But, you know, in the book, you say that children's first efforts to sing are often admirable but rarely musical. Shirley Temple must have been the exception to the rule.
There certainly are some exceptions. Yeah. So, I mean, there are kids with absolute pitch that come from musical families and are able to sing pretty well right away. And then there are people like me who in their, you know, early 40s are still struggling with it.
That whole notion of perfect pitch, where does it come from?
Perfect pitch is a funny thing. It's probably partly built into the brain that we're sensitive to basically particular frequencies. But to really have perfect pitch in the way that people talk about it in the scientific literature, you have to be able to name the notes. And what the notes are varies from culture to culture. So there's a kind of acoustic auditory part of it. And then there's a cultural convention, and you have to line those two. And that takes some kind of practice. And there's probably a genetic component and probably a learned environmental component.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder if there's something similar. A perfect pitch when you're dealing with language. Because some languages tend to be more musical than others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's been some brain research on people who are phoneticians.
Phoneticians.
So who professionally deal with the speech sounds of foreign languages. And they've found that those people have anatomically larger acoustic centers in their brains and that they process sounds different, and that was something that pre-existed any practice or exposure that they had.
But now, how does all this relate to the broader sense of learning? If you can learn language, you can learn music. And you can do that efficiently and with talent. Does that spill over into the rest of your learning ability?
There's some good studies that show very strong correlations between language learning abilities and music learning abilities. We don't really fully understand whether the causal relationship there is that the language, you know, your ear for language helps you with your ear for music or vice versa, whether it's a kind of innate genetic component. I think a good guess is that as you become a musician, it makes you more sensitive to sound in general, and that helps you to learn foreign languages, and probably vice versa.
Well, you had asked, I thought you were going to go in a different direction with that question. I thought you were going to ask about how that spills over into the learning that the rest of
exactly.
us do if we don't. And for me, and for what I was looking at, you know, I had to arrive at the notion that people possess a lot of variation in their brains, which means that they learn in very different ways, which means that method does matter. And that was actually something that I was hoping that Gary might talk about as well. You know, and I'm very interested in learning how to play a musical instrument for the first time myself. Does method matter? In language learning, There's a lot of differing opinion. Some of the hyperpolyglots will say that the method doesn't matter. It's just stick to the method that you choose. Other people will slalom back and forth between methods, I think, to give themselves some variation. So
I think the number one thing to remember if you're learning anything, whether it be a musical instrument or a language, is that practice alone doesn't make perfect. What Anders Ericsson calls deliberate practice is really what you need. So you need to focus on your weaknesses. Regardless of what strategy you use, you can't just sit there rehearsing the things you already know. So there are guitarists that just play the same lick over and over again. They get really good at that lick, but they don't develop broader skills that make them better musicians. I think that in general, you need a strategy where you're focusing on your weaknesses in order to be good. There are different teaching styles, say, in music. There's Suzuki learning, for example.
Sure.
I think what really matters there is the teacher more than the particular technique. So
what about the instrument? Does it make a difference?
Oh,
the
absolutely.
The piano, for example, versus the violin, versus the guitar. Surely some are more difficult than others.
If I knew what I knew now, I would have started with ukulele rather than guitar. The ukulele is a lot more logical than a guitar in some ways. There are four strings that are tuned in a systematic way, and the guitar is this pesky fifth string that's tuned differently. It makes it very hard for the human brain to remember where the notes are. And it's much harder on a guitar than it is on a piano. There's a sort of simple scheme in a piano. Once you can find the C note, you can find it in any octave. But on a guitar, every string is different. So every instrument, I think, has its own unique challenges. And some people's hands are, you know, better shaped maybe for a guitar than other people's hands.
Okay, so take the same idea with language. Are there simply some languages easier to start with if you want to learn several languages? Are there some that make you feel good because you can grasp them immediately and then go on?
Yeah, it depends a lot on what your native language is. So learning Mandarin is very popular right now in the U.S., and that's actually a really good language to start with. Outside of the tones and outside of the writing system, which really takes a lot of time to learn how to do very, very well, the grammar is very easy and should be very familiar to native English speakers, oddly enough, and we wouldn't, because English and Chinese share some interesting characteristics. There are some other languages, for instance, like Indonesian and Hawaiian, where the syllables aren't very complex. There aren't very many consonants or vowels to learn. So it would be easy. I don't want to go so far as to say, regardless of your mother tongue, but yeah, certainly.
I would have thought that because of the musicality of Chinese, that would have been very difficult for someone who speaks English to learn, because one tone might mean one thing and another tone using the same uttered syllable might mean something else.
Yeah, I mean, it can get you into some very awkward social situations, and there's great stories.
Give me an example.
I think the word for cauliflower is the same as the word for syphilis, but with different tones. So you can get yourself in restaurants asking for a sexually transmitted disease. But that doesn't really, you know, that doesn't happen very, I mean, that's not a personal story.
All right. We've got so many callers here, and we'll open the phones now. 800-433-8850 to Franklin, Massachusetts. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Interesting. My question is actually more directed at Gary, but anybody is more than welcome to answer. Gary, my question is, during your research for the book, when you were doing the research to try to come across assertions in learning, did you come across anything where children are better learners because they haven't developed any preconceived notions or beliefs or social paradigms that are actively affecting the plasticity of the brain? So are they learning better because they don't know what they're learning?
Absolutely. And kids are at some advantages because of things that they don't know. The first thing that I would put is they don't know enough to be self-conscious. So especially the youngest kids, they just play and they don't have high expectations, whereas adults want it to sound like the song on the record the first day they play. And adults often give up because they're not playing it the way it is on the record. And the kid will just keep doing some simple pattern until they get it right. So I think that's maybe the number one difference between kids and adults, is just the lack of self-consciousness is a really incredible benefit.
So how does an adult get past that, Gary?
I think adults have to cut themselves slack. I think they have to make a conscious choice and say, I want to learn this thing that's difficult. And that would go for learning a language, too. You wouldn't expect that you're going to be able to speak French in 7 days. I mean, I know there are lots of, you know, websites that promise you guitar or French in 7 days, but it's not realistic. And you have to realize that you're talking about something that requires the whole brain to be rewired, and that's going to take time. So you have to cut yourself the slack.
Is the same thing true with language, Michael?
No, yeah. I mean, there's this hypothesis that the less is more hypothesis, that adults who are superior information processors, that when it comes to learning a language, they're actually trying to take in and process too much, and that the advantage that children have is partly the plasticity, but partly also the immature processing that's going on.
They're just not expecting much more than what they can do.
Right, right.
They're not, you know, same thing with writing. Perhaps a young child beginning a story might simply write, but the adult is self-censoring as he or she goes.
I actually got my start writing with a book called, I think, On Writing Well by William Zinsser. And a lot of that book was really about getting people over those blocks and making it clear that your first draft can be really lousy. It doesn't matter. You get it on the page and you start to revise it. And then that's when it becomes great.
The hyperpolyglots that I spoke with, a lot of them seem to have this Peter Pan quality, such that they wanted to not be adults or not wanted to be treated as adults in a way in their languages, and sometimes sought that experience out in order to, and you could attribute all kinds of psychological, sort of tell stories about how they got that way. But I think that quality of openness and giving yourself slack is definitely true too.
Michael Erard, his book is titled Babel No More, and Gary Marcus, his new book is Guitar Zero, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. To Lansing, Michigan. Hi there, Anthony. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
So I thought I could comment on the learning process in younger students. I'm a professional musician, and the vast majority of my work is teaching a lot of younger students between middle school and high school ages how to play. And I think one of the hardest parts of my job is getting my students to hear what I hear and getting them to hear inflection with greater specificity and the different nuances of music with greater specificity. And I think even in my own playing, trying to hear a greater amount as a professional musician is still the greatest challenge, trying to hear more. And I can comment on just how the brain does rewire itself, even for a professional musician and young students. You can sort of see these changes through time, and it is definitely greater with younger students, but professional musicians go through the same process.
There's a guy named Edwin Gordon, who you may have heard of, but not all the listeners will have, who talks about something called audiation, which is basically being able to imagine what you play before you play it and to have that sense of what other musicians are doing. And I'm sure the same thing is important in language. There's some people that just sort of look at the spelling, but if you really have a mental image of what it's supposed to sound like, you're going to be better off.
Any thoughts there comparable in learning language? Seeing or somehow hearing those words.
Yeah, so there's been some suggestions that a very good predictor of foreign language ability is that ability to keep a string of foreign speech sounds in your head as you are on your way to producing them. One of the interesting methods that I saw someone use, one of the hyperpolyglots, was a method called shadowing, where you listen to foreign language material, just some dialogues or something, and as you are hearing it, you attempt to say it simultaneously, and you do this while you are walking around, exercising with exaggerated gestures, and part of that, you know, works by getting you used to having people stare at you and look at you as if you're crazy. But
which
really
helps with the guitar.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, my gosh. But that's fascinating. I mean, you could do that. You could do that with language. You couldn't very well do that with a musical instrument.
Carrying your grand piano.
Actually, if I can just say, there was a friend who's a teacher who teaches classical instruments, and she says what you should do is you should practice your piece when you're on the subway and you don't have your instrument. And one of the ways
in your head.
You practice it in your head, and one of the ways you get good is you learn by doing that. Where do you space out in a piece, for example? And that's a way to isolate the mistakes that you're making. It goes back to this idea of targeting practice. So anticipating the piece when you don't even have your instrument in hand can be a great thing.
Same with language.
Yeah, there was a Hungarian polyglot named Lom Kato who recommended that you sort of run dialogues with yourself on the train or things like that, and that self-talk in the foreign language definitely helps.
Can I ask you a question, Michael? Mm-hmm. I suspect you talk about it in your book, but I haven't yet finished your book, which is, does dreaming make a difference?
All right, hold that thought. We'll come back to your question after we take a short break. I think we're going to get Gary's ukulele in here and see what happens. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by America's Natural Gas Alliance, whose members are participating in an online registry providing drilling information to the public, fracfocus.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
That horse is all heart. He gets by you, forget about going by him.
That's Dustin Hoffman in the new HBO horse racing series Luck, which begins Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the series creator David Milch, who used to be a compulsive gambler. Milch also created the HBO series Deadwood and co-created NYPD Blue. Join us.
And we're going right back to the phones to Annapolis, North Carolina. Good morning, Jackie. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Diane. First time caller, very long time listener.
Oh, glad to have you with us.
Thank you. My mother was German and my father was American military, and I was born until I was 12 in Germany, not speaking English. And when we moved to the States, I learned to speak English. I didn't go back till I was 21 to visit my grandparents and my family, and by the end of the first day, I was shocked at what was coming out of my mouth because I had not spoken German in so many years and didn't really remember very much of it, but with them not speaking any English, it just sort of started coming out. And by the end of 3 weeks, I was speaking as if I'd done it my entire life.
You were fluent.
Well. Yeah, that's interesting. I've heard a lot of stories like that. And there's a lot of interesting stuff out there about really what it means to learn a language or to lose a language, it's actually harder to lose a language than we think, certainly in a situation like that where you've grown up with a language, but also even high school Spanish.
Because it's retained somewhere
because
in
it's
the
retained.
Brain.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing to remember about memory in the brain is everything goes in there. The problem is usually getting it out. And what you need is the right clue or cue in order to get it out, because that's how the human brain is organized. So what's happening is you're suddenly getting cued for that language. It didn't really disappear. Not that much actually disappears. It's a question of how do I tap into what's already there?
And that's also a very strong emotional situation, right? Returning to the homeland. Yeah.
All right. Let's go to Smyrna Beach, Florida. Good morning, Brendan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
So I went to school for theater and philosophy, so I spent a lot of time sort of looking at language in, you know, like what these really impressive speeches are, and then kind of thinking about why. And as I've noticed, you see certain rhythmic patterns that come up over and over again in pop culture, you know, the St. Crispin's Day speech to part to the big speech from Independence Day. And you see certain syncopations that keep repeating themselves. And then when you look at music, you start seeing patterns like that too, how pop music is built around kind of the same four chords over and over again, how the pentatonic scale seems to mesh really well just with T general. And I was wondering if you guys think there's an innate piece to that, or if it's, you know, for me, it's a chicken and egg argument, and you guys know more than that. So
Gary.
I think that some of it's innate and some of it's learned. So almost all cultures, for example, have some pentatonic scale, but they don't all have the same particular pentatonic scale. That means a scale with five notes that recur over and over again. But the notes can differ from one culture to the next. And scales don't have to be that. So the major scale that we all know is seven notes. So I think there are probably some things that are hardwired that make some things easier to learn than others, but nothing specific about a particular piece of music or a particular linguistic pattern. One other interesting thing there is that you might think of poetry and some music, lyrical music, is actually a combination of language and music, and that might be why we enjoy it so much. There are two different brain systems that are getting stimulated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was liking what he was what he was saying. But just in general, I mean, I like, you know, that thinking about how the brain has helped to evolve culture, and how culture might have returned something to the way that the brain has evolved over human history.
All right, to Louisville, Kentucky. Chet, good morning.
Appreciate you having me on the air, Diane.
Sure.
I was wondering if the acquisition of a tone language, like various Chinese languages, as a primary language, a first language, has any connection or correlation with later ability, later musical ability, or vice versa, if learning a musical instrument or having, you know, early musical ability has a connection with a secondary acquisition of a tonal language.
There's some suggestive but not decisive evidence. So it turns out, for example, that in China, perfect pitch is much more common than it is in the United States. But then again, even in conservatories in China, only about half the people have perfect pitch, and they're you know, chosen for their musical ability to get in there. So speaking a tone language doesn't guarantee that you'll have perfect pitch, but it might help you.
Okay, from Facebook, James says, John Paul II was the most widely traveled pope, supposedly was a hyperpolyglot. I think he spoke 13 languages. Do the guests know if this is true? Michael.
Yeah, putting me in a hard position to have to try to debunk the Pope. I mean, I don't know what he was like in his private audiences or what he spoke in those. I think a lot of what we think of as his linguistic performances were these very large, you know, masses and speeches that he was giving. And those were probably pre-rehearsed and or written down. So did he was able to deliver in a lot of languages. Was he actually speaking them? I don't know.
And second, what do your guests think of language learning programs like Rosetta Stone or the Pimsleur approach? Gary.
I think those things are a start, but there's probably no substitute for talking to a native speaker a lot. And immersion is, for both language and music, is really, really important. So those programs can help you, but you really want to be immersed in a band or a linguistic scenario.
Michael.
Immersion, yeah. Repetition, finding pleasure in repetition, you know, making your brain do stuff that it likes to do.
But Edison Rosetta's don't do exactly that.
It does the repetition part, but it doesn't have the social side or the interactive side.
Yeah.
And there's some pretty good studies that show, for example, that if young kids watch a television program in a foreign language, they don't necessarily pick up anything as compared to if they get the same content, but it's more socially cued, it's more connected to what they're doing.
And Jimmy sends an email, is it helpful to play music to my unborn baby, Gary?
I wouldn't go out of my way to do it. I don't think it could hurt. Babies can actually learn things in the womb. They can learn to recognize particular rhythms, but we don't have any great evidence that suggests there's a long-term benefit for that.
This goes back to something we were talking about earlier. George in Charlotte, North Carolina says, is there an emotional component to learning novel tasks or skill? For example, will a person who can tolerate the frustration of stumbling learn faster or better than those who do not? Michael.
Yeah, certainly. You know, how you feel about the tasks that you're doing makes it easier or harder to perform well in them. Anxiety that you have during performances will get in the way of retrieval. You know, a lot of my book, and I think a lot of Gary's book, and what I like about both of these approaches, though, is that it's getting learning out of the self, out of the conscious self, and into the brain. So it's getting us away from, in your case, it's practice. In my case, it's more motivation and willpower. We have this larger sense that if people aren't successful, they must not want it badly enough, or they must not be motivated enough to do it. And that's really not the whole story, that term will to plasticity. In our culture, we overprivilege the will part of that equation, I think, and we don't understand the plasticity part, how the brain actually changes.
But aren't there sometimes negative voices that can get in the way, Gary?
One of the things that I got to do in the course of writing this book was to interview different people who are teachers. And one of my favorite teachers is Michelle Horner, a Suzuki teacher. And she has this saying, she actually teaches the parents. She figures you're going to practice more outside than you are at the classes. So it's really important to get the parents on board emotionally so that they don't discourage the kids. So she says to the parents, never, ever correct your child unless they've made the same mistake at least 3 times. And that's all about keeping the whole process of learning fun. The minute it's not fun, people stop.
There was a group that I visited in the U.S. It's called the Lex Language Project. In Japan, it's called the Hippo Family Project, and it's a language learning club whose motto is anyone can learn 7 languages. And you play CDs in the background at home in 23 languages, and then you get together as a group and you do dances and games and kind of a language karaoke. And as far as the language performances, the accents were a little off, but the overall emotional tenor was, you can do it, we love what you're doing, total acceptance, really fun.
That's great. And here is Eric. He's in Canton, Ohio. Good morning, Eric.
Hello there. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
For taking my call today.
Surely.
Hey, very interesting conversation. Several years ago, probably in the 90s, there was a study done, and I'm not sure if your one speaker refers to it in his book on language at all, where they did physiological studies on the brain and found that when we were born, supposedly we have thousands of speech centers, and as we get older, it focuses into the left brain, into one spot, but that as if you have a child or infant that grows up in a bilingual or multilingual family, that those speech centers do not close down as they do in those of us who come from a monolingual family, and therefore that those children are more capable of picking up and learning foreign languages a lot easier in multiple languages.
Yeah, that early exposure definitely matters. But interestingly, I did an online survey of people who could speak 6 or more languages. And among the people who said that they could speak, or that they knew, rather, more than 11, only a third of them came from a bilingual home environment. So their overall trajectory as language learners did not seem to be determined by the fact that they grew up with a lot of languages.
I think for an instrument or for language, often what really matters is the passion. So you can start with one language, or in my case, no musical talent whatsoever. And if you're dedicated enough, you can learn something.
Interesting. To Brian in New Philadelphia, Ohio. Good morning to you, Brian.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, sir.
I'd like to ask, I have a 2-year-old daughter who I'm interested in getting her playing the guitar. I play the guitar myself, and she loves when I pick it up. Loves music in general. At what age can children actually cognitively start to understand what's happening, and will it do any good to put the strings on the children's guitar I have and let her start going at it?
Gary.
I don't think it could hurt. I would focus more on rhythm than anything else at that age. I wouldn't focus on playing complicated licks or anything like that, but anything you can do to develop a sense of rhythm is probably a good thing. There are things like the Eurythmics or Dalcroze method that are more about like just walking in time and maybe beating a drum in time. That might be easier than actually playing guitar, but there's no reason why a 2-year-old can't get started.
What about the recorder? That's the way both of my kids began and then went on to the piano. The recorder teaches you the difference between notes with the marching, with the rhythm, all the rest.
In my case, the recorder actually taught me the opposite. So I took recorder lessons in fourth grade. And when I took lessons... recorder lessons in fourth grade, I was so bad I couldn't play Mary Had a Little Lamb, and the teacher suggested that my talents lay elsewhere. So for some people, the recorder is actually difficult, and I got the lesson that I couldn't do it, and it took me about 35 years
to realize
that maybe I could actually do this.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's hear this little snippet.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get a little help from my friends. I get a little help from my friends.
Gary, tell us a little about this.
My first live singing performance, a friend of mine, Dave Barrett, or two friends of mine, Dave Barrett and Roger Greenewalt, encouraged me to sing a Beatles cover. And they were doing all the Beatles songs on ukulele. And of course, we had some thought about what would be the appropriate song. And since we all knew how hard it was going to be for me to sing on my own, it was obvious that with a little help from my friends was the right thing to do. I have a link to that song up on my website, so you can hear my first studio performance with a little help from my friends.
What did you have to do for yourself, to yourself, to get that going?
A lot of practice. And I would say that, you know, there's still room for improvement. I also picked a Ringo Starr song since he wasn't known for his singing ability.
All right. And let's take one more call. Let's go to Cal in Rochester, New York. Cal, you're on the air.
Hey there. This question is really about fluency and improvisation. So I have at various times in my life taught foreign language and music, and I am now actually an instructor here in Rochester, and I teach improvised comedy. And one of the things that I'm wondering if the guests have something to comment about is that part of what artistic fluency is about making mistakes and not being judgmental.
Yes, and they say.
As opposed to just memorizing technique. And I wonder if they could talk about the differences and things they've noticed regarding that.
Michael.
Yeah, I think improv comedy is great. I've done improv comedy in my classes as well. You know, I think it's kind of the Gen X, Gen Y Toastmasters. Rather than focusing on delivery, you focus on the nature of the interaction and the ability to trade back and forth a series of, what do they call them, offers in order to set a scene. Yeah.
my own musical learning has been different from a lot of people because I haven't played that many covers, notwithstanding the one that you heard a minute ago. And almost all of what I've done actually has been learning about improvisation. I get incredible pleasure from being able to make up my own music, even if it's not top 40 material. I just, the chance to make up something new really keeps me going.
Are you in the process, Michael, of learning any new languages?
You know, I'm not. Really, the thing that I'm most intrigued with doing right now is learning, picking up an instrument, because I have a 2-year-old at home, and if we were living in a part of the country where there was a foreign language, community, or I might do that, but I think that it's important for him to see me try to do something new. I want him to see what that process is like for me. I don't know if I'll how well I'll handle that, certainly, but I want to model that and be able to, you know, include him in that.
And what's the instrument?
Oh, I don't know. I was going to ask Gary. Ukulele, it sounds like.
Ukulele, start with. Well, what a fascinating conversation with both of you. Michael Erard, his book is titled Babel No More, and Gary Marcus, his is Guitar Zero. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from